This episode contains discussions of sexual violence and graphic descriptions of anti-Semitic violence and killings. Listener discretion is advised. Hello.
Hello,
and welcome to Lights Up on the Dark, the podcast where we explore the hows, whys, ifs, whats and whens of what it means to represent the Holocaust on stage. Zooming in from New York is co-host Alexandra Gellner, aka Alex.
And sitting in front of me in London is co-host Samantha Michka, aka Dr. Sam.
How are you, my dear? How is life? How is love?
Just
how is
a little under the weather, as you can probably hear from my voice and how I'm just like on my words. But how about you?
I'm good. I have not seen any Holocaust related theater. I think I maxed it all out during the last episode. Mm-hmm. I think there are a couple of things on my radar coming up, so I will be plugging those a little bit nearer to the time, but yeah. Apart from that, chugging along, life is continuing. The world is turning, even though it's still on fire. We're all good.
We're fine. Yeah, I'd honestly be surprised if you managed to get to another Holocaust play.
I feel like you're throwing down a gauntlet for me, Alex.
Yeah,
so, you know, challenge accepted.
It's not a challenge. I'm just gonna be like, oh my gosh, what
another one?
What is going on with our theater seasons? It's great, but it's also
a bit bleak.
A bit bleak.
How about you?
Well, nothing for me, but as I do have a reading/listening recommendation, if you have a New York Times subscription. At this point, New York Times should pay me for promoting them. They're fine. Fingers crossed.
Hashtag sponsor.
Yeah. But there was there's a article that's been making the rounds in Holocaust organization circles called "This Is the Holocaust Story I Said I Wouldn't Write" by Taffy Brodesser Ackner, sorry if I butchered your name. There's also a lovely audio recording read by Gabra Zachman that is just really beautiful. It's about an hour long listen.
Okay, and what's it about?
Subline is, for years, my friend's father asked me to recount his childhood escape from the Nazis. Why did it take me this long? So it's about this, just basically this writer just grappling with, I'm Jewish. I had all my Holocaust education. Why do I have to keep going back to it? Why do I have to keep reading about it? And so it really delves into, I think, what a lot of us as Holocaust educators probably deal with a lot, which is the fatigue, especially if you're Jewish. Just, you know, you're expected to know everything there is to know about the Holocaust. Like, don't you know that's your history? It's like, it's not our only history. Like, you know, right. Like a rejection that happens. Understandably so, but yeah, it's a really touching story, and just really asks some questions of just pressure we also are feeling now that we're losing our survivors, the pressure of asking the right questions, and maybe also being okay with asking some, like, quote unquote wrong ones, like maybe with some that are a little scary, but that would be valuable for us.
Uncomfortable ones. Sure. Yeah. What's the article called again?
This is the Holocaust story I said I wouldn't write.
Okay. I guess what I'm doing this weekend. There we go.
I recommend listening. Like going on a nice walk and just having your headphones.
Yeah. Now, following on from the last episode, we asked Holocaust educators to tell us about their experiences with The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, or BISP, as everybody has taken to referring to it online, because let's face it, the title is too long to type. So we were asking if educators had worked with it before, if they would never work with it, if they would work with it under certain conditions. And we've got a couple of three responses out of the ones we got. I think they pretty much represent the range of views. So, let's hear from the educators.
All right. So, Jamie said, I think the boy in the striped pajamas has done immeasurable damage to Holocaust education in the UK. It's a sentimental and implausible piece of nonsense which fundamentally ignores. Sorry, I don't mean to laugh,
I
but I'm just like
know, right?
shots
Don't
are
hold
being
back. Say what
fired.
you really think. Some of my copper chose violence. Like,
Which
okay.
fundamentally ignores the history of the Auschwitz site in particular and the Holocaust in general, because it focuses on the perpetrators without actually making a serious link between their work and the ending. It distorts on every level. The challenge for Holocaust educators is to ensure that the aging class sets of the book, which have proved so hard to dislodge, aren't replaced with more copies. There are Holocaust memoirs that could and should be used instead. There we
Jamie left
go.
no crumbs.
Eight.
Jamie ate and left no crumbs. Jamie out here saying it
I
as
don't think that's how we're supposed to use the term, but it's fine.
it's just, I don't know, I'm not down for the kids. Yeah, I mean, there's not really much you can say to that. I mean, I have had several conversations with Jamie in the past about the boy in striped pajamas, and he has been really, really clear that this is how he feels about it. So I'm absolutely not surprised. So yeah, I think the next one is Anna.
Anna said, when I first saw Boy in Striped Pajamas, I didn't hate it because I thought of it as an allegory. Its own subtitle is a fable. I really didn't think much of it, except another piece of Holocaust media, until I started doing education and realized that teachers weren't just calling it an allegory, but were teaching it like it was an actual great piece of Holocaust literature. This is so problematic as it has barely any focus on the Jewish child. I don't think it's totally taught in a way in which kids are looking at the overarching themes, but it's done in a place of actual Holocaust lessons. It offers little, if not almost nothing, of historical value for a teacher to build on. If Then series by Morris Gleitzman and Number of the Stars are both fictional, but at least offer actual historical facts one that one could build on. But using it instead of actual Holocaust literature creates misconceptions and frames righteous Gentiles as much more common than they were. With my social media, I recently had someone defend Trump's statements on quote unquote nice Nazi guards by citing this book. Ugh, as though it really happened. Scathing indictment on the book itself. I've also had teachers tell me after pointing out how problematic the book is that they have to use it because students seem to resonate with it. And because of that, it erases all of its issues as though there aren't other books students could resonate with if they put in effort to find it. I might use the book in a university or postgraduate course about Holocaust literature and the problems in Holocaust education. I would never use it as a way to introduce the Holocaust to students, and I think its historical inaccuracies need to be pointed out. Honestly, when used in Holocaust education, it suffers from a lot of the same issues as Schindler's List being used in secondary schools, though at least that's a true story and actually a good movie. But that's a whole other topic.
See, I have questions because that's a really interesting point. It suffers from a lot of the same issues as Schindler's List being used in secondary schools. How? How so?
I
Like,
think
what?
because it's focusing so much on the perpetrators slash righteous Gentiles.
That's a very good point. Well presented. Yes. Okay.
I think is how I'm interpreting it.
Yeah, no, oh, okay. Well, as Anna said, that's a whole other topic. But yeah, no,
Another
that's a
topic.
we love a good other topic. And then the
I had to
final
stop myself from saying righteous gemstones.
the final one that we have is my friend John again, the mythical John, who is going to start charging commission every time I
Wise, wise
mention his
John.
name. He got in touch well, first of all, to say that he would love to come on here and talk to us. So that will be a future episode. But he also had this to say about the boy in striped pajamas. And he said, I do teach the boy in the striped pajamas, but I've got a really intensive Holocaust education course. So my pupils in the first, second, and third year learn all about the Holocaust in drama. In the fourth year, which is their GCSE year, that's one of the plays that we focus on, especially for students who are wanting to do costume, set design, props, etc. But it was really interesting what you were saying in the episode, because I took it as the writer is taking this perspective that in the 2000s, we became interested and quite invested in the people of Germany and what happened to them. So things like Kate Winslet in The Reader, The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, etc. give a different perspective.
Mm.
But then it's not taking away the perspective that the Holocaust was about the Jewish people, which I think gets lost sometimes by educators. If you're going to teach The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas at school, then you need to be a Holocaust educator who can teach the whole background to it.
Amen. Yeah.
So I think that the key sort of takeaway is either don't use it at all, or know what the hell you're talking about before you go anywhere near it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The educators have spoken.
Yeah. I like what he offers, though, here, too, just that the book is honestly kind of a product of its time as well.
Yeah. Shall we do this week's episode, my dear?
Let's dive in. But before we start, it is time for the disclaimers.
So, number one, Alex and I both work for outside organisations, but this podcast is entirely on us. We don't represent them in our podcasting capacity. We don't speak for them. This is our passion project. So if you don't like something you hear, blame us.
Number two, the Holocaust is an incredibly dark subject. So because we work with it every day, we use humor as a coping mechanism. We are not mocking the Holocaust. We are not mocking victims or survivors. We in no way intend to be disrespectful. We do use dark humor at times. So please bear this in mind while listening.
And number three is our rule of engagement. If you have questions, a suggestion for an episode, a correction, a comment, let us know, please. You can find the contact details in the show notes. We really want to hear from you. And while we're on the subject as well, I think it's worth noting, and other podcasters will probably laugh hysterically, but we have now reached, a few days ago, we reached our first 50 streams on Spotify, which I'm thrilled. I'm going to take that as a win.
Listen, that's huge. So, podcasts are so hard to get off the ground, and they're such hard work.
So we did. Yeah. And
we did it,
you guys. So thank you so much. Thank you for engaging with us and listening to us. And long may it continue.
Yes, thank you, Jamie. Thank you, John. Thank you, Anna. Appreciate you guys. All right, everybody who skips past the disclaimers, you can stop clicking the 15-second button. We're okay. We're here. All right. Shall we?
Let's do it.
Today, we're looking at the English language version of Our Class by Tadeusz Sobodzianiec, translated and adapted by Ryan Craig.
So following on from the content warning at the top of the episode, this week's one is pretty nasty. Anything to do with the Holocaust is awful by definition, but the historical context around this one is its own kind of horrendous. So please do listen at your own discretion.
Right. And there's been a lot of controversy in Poland around the historical events because Polish people were perpetrators.
Right. Yeah. So we're looking at the Jedwabne massacre, or the Jedwabne pogrom, of July 1941. So much has been written and made about Jedwabne. But the two sources we've drawn upon most heavily for the history in this episode are the website of the Museum of the History of Polish Jews, or POLIN, and contestedhistories.org. I actually didn't know about Contested Histories until I started researching for this episode. Seriously, you should absolutely check out their website. It's brilliant. They look at like statues and memorials and street names and sort of things that exist in the public sphere, and it's examples, hundreds of case studies from all around the world, and what constitute contested histories, and where there's differing versions of events and accounts, and you know, so they look at, well, statues that were built in memorial to people who were actually slave traders, for example, in like colonial history and Holocaust history, and it's fascinating. You can get lost in there for hours. So I definitely recommend taking a look. So the link for contested histories for Poland, and as always, all the other sources will be in our show notes. So there's a short definition of what happened at Jedwabne on the Poland website in the very cheerily entitled Timeline of Pogroms in the Former Soviet Occupation Zone, Summer of 1941. And it's very short and very to the point, and it simply says, mass murder perpetrated on the Jewish population by a group of Polish inhabitants of the town in the presence and probably also at the inspiration of Germans. Some victims were killed with clubs, knives, etc., but the majority was burned alive in a barn. So when I read that, and read it as bluntly put at that, that made me go, how in the name of multiple deities did Tadeusz Swobodzianek look at that story and go, oh, I know, I'll turn it into a play. But he did. And it bloody works. Yeah. And we'll come to that later. But we're going into the history a bit more with this one than we have done previously, because we talked about it and just felt that it was really the right thing to do and to situate it properly, because it is so controversial. And it's a controversy that still goes on to this day. So the town of Jedwabne is located in northeastern Poland. It's still there to this day. Before the Second World War, its population was around 2,800, and about 60% were Catholic and 40% were Jewish. So as part of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, where the Soviets and the Nazis working together agreed to carve Poland up between them, Jedwabne fell under Soviet occupation in September 1939. But then on June the 22nd, 1941, after Operation Barbarossa, which infamously was where Hitler essentially turned on the Soviet Union, the town then came under Nazi occupation. On the 10th of July, perhaps the most infamous and controversial pogrom in Polish history occurred in the then German-occupied Jedwabne. At around 10 a.m., Polish inhabitants of Jedwabne and nearby villages, under German supervision, started to herd Jews from the town to the market square. There, the Jews were beaten and humiliated, and several of them were killed. Out of the people gathered in the market square, Poles selected several dozen and forced them to destroy the statue of Lenin on a street called Dvorna Street and to stage its mock funeral. The group was then led out of the town, murdered and buried, along with the smashed bust of Lenin, in a previously dug out hole inside a barn. Later on, all the remaining Jews were rushed from the market square to that same barn, which was then set on fire. 18-year-old Shmuel Wasserstein, a Jewish resident, later gave a statement in April 1945 where he detailed that the beards of old Jews were burned, newborn babies were killed at their mother's breasts, people were beaten and forced to sing and dance as their neighbours and friends were killed. At that time, so shortly after the German invasion of the USSR, Germans were actually perceived as saviours from the cruel Soviet occupation by the local population. And I think in this context, it's really important to remember that up until that point, for hundreds of years, Poland had continuously been occupied by one country or another. So I think the first time there was actually a properly independent Poland in sort of within that sort of recent-ish history was after the First World War. If I'm wrong, historians, please let me know. So with this in mind, so the Russians have invaded, then the Nazis have driven the Russians out, the Soviets out. So then the Nazis are now seen as saviours by the local Polish population. But then the sort of the rhetoric of the Nazis and that the ideology of the Nazis based on sort of anti-Semitic prejudice and that sort of quote-unquote Judeo-communism stereotype which is, you know, that the Jews are all communists, communists are all Jews, vice versa, mm-hmm. Especially coming on the back of the Soviet Union, was met with a lot of enthusiasm. So then the pogrom in Yerevan was actually a symbolic revenge on Jews for the Soviet repression of the Poles. And the victims were basically condemned for the alleged affiliation of the entire Jewish community with the communists. So the Jews are blamed for what the Soviets have done. But the crime in Yerevan, it wasn't an isolated case, but actually was part of a widespread local phenomenon. So a similar slaughter had taken place in a town nearby 3 days earlier. And then in the summer of 1941, there was anti-Jewish violence in over 20 localities throughout nearby regions. So again, what we're seeing is that reaction to the Soviets being pushed out by the Nazis and then the Jews being blamed for what the Soviets had done. And these events were part of the wave of pogroms that swept through the eastern front line in the territories stretching from Latvia to Bessarabia. So vast swathes of land and vast swathes of pogroms. But the contentious question is whether the Polish Catholics of Yerevan initiated the pogrom themselves or were following orders from the Nazis. Mm. Between 1949 and 1950, 22 Polish defendants implicated in the pogrom were put on trial, accused of collaborating with Germans during the massacre. 12 of these men were convicted of treason against Poland and one was sentenced to death. But then it was later proven that torture had been used by the security office to extract 6 confessions. And so the accused were actually released. In year 2000 through to 2003, a new investigation into the Yerevan pogrom was carried out by the Institute of National Remembrance and ended up with an unequivocal conclusion that the pogrom was committed by Poles, encouraged by the Germans. The site of the crime and burial was located, which as soon as I read that, I was like, I'm sorry, what? So it had essentially been hidden, whether by accident or design, but it had been hidden. It was located, a monument was erected and unveiled on the 60th anniversary of the event. And during the unveiling ceremony, Aleksander Kwaśniewski, president of Poland, apologized, quote, on his own behalf and on behalf of those Poles whose conscience was stirred by what had happened here 60 years ago. Now, you would think that that would not be the end of the story, but that would be some kind of closure. There would be some kind of coming to terms with it. And, you know, the fact that there had been this investigation by the Institute of National Remembrance, which is in Poland, it's a, you know, Polish institute, would not lay to rest, but like I say, sort of give some closure, and it actually didn't. So on the Poland website, it says, revealing the truth of the crime in Yerevan in 2000 came as a shock to public opinion as it challenged the image of Poles as solely victims of World War II. Discussion on the subject of the Yerevan pogrom turned out to be one of the key debates on the modern history of Poland. And they've written that in the present tense, like the debate is still not ongoing, and unfortunately it still is. Because there's one group that say, or one group of people who say, no, you know, it was the Nazis and it was a setup and Poles are being blamed for it, and other people are saying, well, no, it was Polish people and we need to take responsibility for that, and, you know, it was anti-Semitic, and these were Polish people being anti-Semitic, committing anti-Semitic murders. We need to accept responsibility for that. And one of the key texts about Yerevan is Jan Gross's book Neighbours, which is, you know, it's not a long book, but it's devastating, because it lays out the events, it lays out what happened, and it's actually Gross's book that our class is primarily based on, or is one of the key sources that it's based on. Which leads us quite nicely into talking about the play. And like I said before, you kind of, when you read that history and look at that history, you go, how the hell could this be turned into a play?
Mm-hmm.
But you have seen it, I have seen it, and somehow it works.
Yeah. To listeners who haven't heard of this play before, the play Our Class follows 10 Polish classmates. Five are Catholic, five are Jewish, and we're following them from their childhood. From what I saw, they had the years, along with like the titles of every scene, which were lesson one, lesson two, lesson three. They also had the years that were being covered, which was extremely helpful. So we're meeting them, Poland, 1925. In the characters list, you see the names of all the characters and their year of birth and year of death. So they're about five. So like we're meeting them ages five, six, seven. And with the opening scene where we're meeting everyone, they say their name, what their parents, what their dad does, not their mom. They say their name, what their dad does, and what they would like to do when they grow up. And then from there, 10 years later, this is at scene three or lesson three, something happened that changed our destinies forever. The whole country was in mourning. Everyone wept. Jews more than anyone. And so that's when, and that's 1935. The way the play started for me, it's, and I don't know if this works for you, of if we like share, like, okay, what do you remember from your opening, the opening moment in the show that you saw and what I saw?
So, because you saw it live and I saw it when I was doing some research at the National Theatre Archives.
Yeah.
So I watched the video recording of the original production, and the first thing the first memory that I have is of them singing, but they were also doing gestures while they were singing, you know, the way that little kids do, you know, like, oh, this, the bird took off and flew and did all, and, you know, sort of doing the hand gestures to sort of demonstrate. So, and that was a recurring motif throughout the play whenever they sang. Because it is interspersed with what I'm presuming are either actual children's songs or meant to be children's songs or childhood songs. They kept that up all the way through as a motif. Everyone would be singing together and doing the gestures. So that's what I first was presented with.
Nice. So the production I saw live in New York, and it was actually adapted by Norman Allen. I read the Ryan Craig adaptation to refresh my memory. So this was in February of 2024, and at BAM, Brooklyn Academy of Music, and directed by Igor Goliak, who is a article from the foreword. Says Goliak is an immigrant, a refugee, really, from what is now Ukraine, but was the Soviet Union when he was growing up. So in the opening, I remember, so the production was very, had a kind of a blackboard, black backdrop, where they had projections that looked like, you know, writing in chalk, and then they would also write in the blackboard in chalk themselves. But it was mostly projections where they would have the names and the years written out, and all the actors kind of came in looking like themselves, the actors, and would just, as the audience was arriving, they were arriving on stage. They took a seat in front of a music stand where their bound scripts were waiting for them. And, you know, when everybody was ready, when if the lights slightly dimmed, they were all ready, and they shared their names, the actors, and then also dealt in the script saying, my name is Abram, my daddy is Shlomo, the shoemaker, and they went down the line like that. So we knew who they were as actors, we knew who they were playing. And that sort of echoes throughout, and I realized as the play was going on what Igor was doing in just kind of getting rid of that boundary between, and that distance between the audience and the play that was going on. To remind us, like, this is not so distant. This is not so far away. You are not so safe.
Oh, see, I
From
see
these themes and
hearing you recount that, I was thinking that actually the opposite, that that was almost a device to kind of put up a layer of protection, because some of the, I mean, we'll come to it shortly, but some of the things that are represented and the acts that are committed are horrendous. And it's almost like giving them that, oh, I am so and so, you are safe because I am not, I am playing this character, and kind of giving that element of psychological safety. But yeah, I can see why, for example,
You're right. I
reading
probably shouldn't have.
between. No, I think it, because the thing is, you can never, I mean, you and I both know, you can and never should say the audience as one living, breathing thing with one mindset and one singular set of thoughts is going to react in this way and take it. So I think it's really interesting that you and I would probably have both gone to see that production together, and I would have gone, oh, it was a safety thing, and you'd have gone, no, it's actually warning them that these themes aren't that distant. So
But you are right. It does also create that kind of, how do I say it? It's Brechtian in that way. Just like these are actors, you're seeing a play. You're aware of that you're seeing a play. Also notice, and this is maybe a little less Brechtian, but to encourage, like also notice the impact this is having on you emotionally. So that's where it kind of veers away from a sort of Brechtian presentation, but I'm starting to get lost in the weeds here.
No,
But I
it's good.
just that's one of the things I really liked about the production, because it was just so bare bones in that way, and it was really just it was inviting the audience to really stay engaged, stay forward, use your imagination, and also remember we are just visiting this world, but it also is not so far away, and
And
these things are
that's,
still happening here.
yeah, and that's one of the things that I really enjoyed about the play and engaged with, whether, watching the recording or reading the text, is that it humanizes everybody, the victims, the perpetrators, the survivors. We see the childhood games and the crushes, we see the school performances and, the school plays, we see the relationships through from the, like, say, from ages 5, 6 through to bullying in, even before the Nazis or the Soviets have turned up, we're seeing that bullying on anti-Semitic grounds. And then all the way through sort of the adult relationships, with Dora and Menachem, and, they get married, but they don't have a very happy marriage. She feels she's stuck at home with the baby all the time, he's out drinking, and she's like, fine, you're off out with your whores again, all this kind of thing. So the whole gamut of sort of these human relationships within, you sort of have that microcosm of community taking place within this like bigger historical context.
And you start out the play just, knowing these characters based off of their name, what their dads do, and what they want to be. And then you start to slowly discover who's Catholic, who's Jewish.
Yeah, lesson 4. Dear classmates, it is now time for a prayer. In accordance with the new directives handed down by the Minister of Education, I would at this time ask our Jewish colleagues to repair to the back of the class. They do. Many thanks. And it's also kind of, it's horrid, but also comic, because he's talking in very corporate tones, and it's meant to be set when 1935. So they're 1915 at this point. Yeah, it's after
It's
the
after
funeral.
1935, so
So they're even older.
So yeah, so the start so some of the anti-Semitic, acts are starting to come out in the village. Some of the students are smashing up Jewish shops or breaking windows, throwing stones at girls, and then talking about it in the class because they're all, they're growing up together. They're going to dances together. They're going to the movies. There's a cinema that opens up.
And there's the one classmate, Abram, who, for
Who
want of a
moves to
better way of,
America?
yeah, want a better way of putting it, gets out. When you hear from him throughout and his letters, and he's writing to them and saying, why does nobody write to me anymore? or
yeah,
when he is written to and told, you know, all of your, most of your classmates are dead, or they were killed by so on and so forth. And yeah, just again, just sort of that microcosm of the diaspora, and, you know, Jews being on the move, you know, in whether there's a pogrom coming or there has been a pogrom, or they just feel, no, we're going to leave, we're getting, you know, getting out in the nick of time. You know, he leaves in 1937, and just seeing it from that perspective as well, was really powerful.
Yeah. And in the production I saw, that was actually played by, I want to say, maybe the oldest actor in the cast. So everybody was wearing, you know, modern day clothes, like, you know, 2024, probably from their own wardrobes, to be honest, or inspired by each actor's own wardrobe, and varying ages. Youngest was probably Dora, I want to say. And the way that they portrayed the letter writing is he had a video camera, and they would, and he would, you know, do a sort of video cam letter, and they would project it onto the screen, and they would all gather together in front of it and watch.
Oh, wow.
So, like, you see, like, this camaraderie as classmates throughout.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, that just, like, there's some, like, you know, little tinges of violence and aggression here and there that ultimately then culminates in to first the rape and then the massacre. Yeah. Or I guess it would be first the murder of Jakob Katz.
Yeah.
And then Dora's rape, and then the burning of the barn.
I think I'm really interested in your perspective in terms of, because it's the events that we've mentioned, they're talked about in the present tense, in the past tense. So it's almost like a kind of testimony. But they're saying, you know, they're talking, so for example, Dora's rape, as a woman, the account of the sexual violence is horrendous. There are so many things about it that struck me, and I'm going to, you know, sort of focus on that sequence in particular, but also with the other events that happen, with the massacre, with you know, Jakob's murder, is that you hear all these different points of view at the same time. So in the rape sequence, you hear from Dora, and then you hear from Rajek, and then you hear from Heniek, and you hear from Sigmund. And their accounts all vary slightly. So they'll be similar, but there'll be something. And then as that goes on, things like that happen again throughout the play. And you go, hang on, no, what he has said there, that person has said that. Not necessarily in. So the example that I'm thinking of is when it's Jakob's murder. One of the I forget now, but one of the characters talks about feeling he smashes his head in with a paving slab, and he feels something splash on his face, and he wipes it off and realizes it's Jakob's brain. And then one of the other characters says, and then he licked his fingers.
Yeah,
that is a horrific piece of imagery. But then also the fact that he says, oh, and then he licked his fingers, but the one who's meant to have licked his fingers doesn't say anything about it. Isn't a confirmation or a denial. It's just, so then you're left going, is that true? Is that right? Who do we believe? They were all there. But these different versions. And then for me, that feeds so cleverly into the whole controversy around Yad Vabna, because so many people were there. And so many of the accounts are different, similar or different, or directly contradictory.
Yeah.
So I've gone off on a massive tangent there, but coming back to the rape sequence.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts?
I mean, it's always hard to see that depicted on stage. And there are some, you know, you go to some productions where there's sexual assault, and it somehow, it's just sensationalized in a way, or it's just like a little too graphic. But this production was, you know, had created that a little bit of distance, so it was a bit stylized. There was they used ladders quite a bit in this production. From what I remember, because now it's a little over a year, Dora is up on the ladder, and the men are below her. So visually, she's the highest point, which you could say, position of power, and Reichiek is just below her. So he's not even like on top of her. He's like basically at her feet, and you know, there's motions to suggest the assault, and the light is on her, and you hear the men below her. Still hard to watch because you know what's
Yeah,
happening.
I remember. So, in the one that I saw, yeah, they there were no ladders, but they grabbed her, and it was they were speaking the lines, and like you said, there were motions, but there were it was again quite stylized. I think the word I keep coming back to is quite responsible, because and yeah, it's I mean, for readers, for listeners who don't know the play, it is a gang rape, and it yeah, and you read it and you go, how the hell could this? Because if it's done badly, it's going to be done really badly. But it sounds like neither you nor I were on the receiving end of a badly done production. And it again, it was very responsibly done. And one of the things that I'm not going to say I liked about it, but I think you know what I mean when I say I liked about it, is that it raised the issue of sexual violence against women during the Holocaust. Because so many of the survivor accounts after the Holocaust were dominated by men, and then you also have the male perpetrator trope, with sort of, you know, women, whether they were perpetrators, victims, survivors, kind of sidelined, and then sort of placing that very female experience. I'm not saying that, you know, Jewish men and boys didn't experience sexual assault, but placing that particular female experience back into literally the spotlight, and saying this happened, is important. And whether or not people agree with that, you know, is open for discussion. But I've, you know, I think of a play that I saw recently where a woman gave a very, very graphic account of being gang raped, and it was so sensationalized, and it was awful, and should not have been in there. So then to have something like this, I don't know. I think you'd definitely work with it with older students. This is not a play
This is
for a
not for.
classroom. This is a room for a lecture theatre, or a play for a lecture theatre, or a seminar,
A seminar, yeah.
or a rehearsal room, not a classroom. Because just no.
But yeah, if you have a student that's particularly interested in Poland during the Holocaust and this particular massacre and all just, you know, where all this controversy is coming from, I feel like this would be a good text to go to just to have that.
And what's really clever about it as well is that Yad Vabna is never actually referred to by name.
It's
It's
not, yeah.
super clear what it's about, but it doesn't, and it also doesn't really go into questions of who's to blame or Polish anti-Semitism or, you know, the huge issues. It kind of zooms right in and looks at the individuals.
Yeah, there's no main character. It's all, you know, it's very much an ensemble piece. It's the class.
And one of the things I really liked as well was the fact that even after, you know, the Jewish characters have been murdered, they're still there. So they still come back and they still talk, and there's that incredible sequence where Rachelka, who is a Jewish girl. She is saved by her Polish classmate, Vladek, and he marries her. And she converts to Catholicism, and then they're having like the wedding reception, and they're being brought gifts. And, you know, one of the Catholic classmates says, "Oh, I've brought you a candlestick, and it's silver." And someone else says, "Oh, where did you get that from?" And Dora, who is dead, goes, like, "It's mine." And then there's a sequence of, and you'll probably have to bleep this, but there's a sequence of items being brought, you know, like a candlestick and, you know, tablecloth and all these different things. "So I brought you this. Where did you get it?" And then a different murdered Jew says, "Mine." And then another Menachem says, "F me." And then they sort of have this ongoing, it becomes almost ritualistic, you know, a tray from me, silver, whose is this? Mine. God, f*** me, thanks, lovely. A sugar bowl, silver, whose? Mine. God, f*** thanks, lovely. And it's so awkward. You, first of all, you're kind of like, oh, that's, and it, the sequence is no more than what, it's not even 2 pages long.
Yeah.
And it is so uncomfortable.
Oh, God. And Mihalka / Mariana has handed her own tablecloth and napkins back because all those houses were pillaged. Yeah.
And you just, you laugh and then you feel bad for laughing. Because when she's given her own stuff back and you're like, oh, that's embarrassing. Cringe. Is that cringe? Is cringe the right word to say? And and just that.
It's awkward.
Yeah. And awful.
Yeah.
And what did you think of the characters? Coming back to Rahelka, again, that experience of assimilating and hiding her true identity when everyone in the village knows who she is. So she converts and, you know, there's virtually no other Jews left in the area. And then when she hides herself essentially and sort of becomes a Catholic. What were your thoughts on that? Because that story plays up. She's one of the, because you said earlier, you know, she's one of, all the characters have the lists of like their birthdays and or their birth years and when they died. And she is one of the, you know, she's one of the longest survivors.
Oh yeah.
So I just wondered what your thoughts were on that aspect.
It was easy to follow, hard to watch. The actor I saw playing her was, she was amazing. I'd seen her in another show. I would love to have her on the pod.
should speak to the executive producer about it and see what she says.
Yeah. I'll send you a memo later. This is one of the impossible questions, I think, that are, you know, it's you want to ask survivors, but you hesitate to. Of just like, you know, what gave you the will to survive? What made you want to survive? Your whole family was gone. And then you see the life that she leads afterwards, which is hard. I mean, it's, for lack of a better word, a pretty loveless marriage, but he seems to have some affection for her. He keeps rescuing her. You know, she almost gets carted off again by one of her classmates, who is being incentivized by the Germans to, you know, really make sure is every Jew in your village gone. And it's like, well, I know, you know, Rahelka, but. Her husband, sorry, I'm also blanking on his name again.
Vladek.
Vladek is keeps rescuing her, and I mean she, I think there's a part of her that is, you know, from the script and from production, there's some gratitude, but also, I think resistance against that gratitude because he is still there's still microaggressions that come out in him every once in a while. So it's,
and even on their wedding night where, you know, they have sex and he sort of finishes and then says, oh, was that really your first time? I thought all G-birds were slags.
Exactly.
And you're like, I'm sorry, what?
I mean, that's a macroaggression.
yes.
Yeah. Really wonders, like, what exactly is he going for? Really delving into it as an actor and just, like, thinking about what is driving these people. Maybe just a constant, you know, attempt to try to get back to that time when they were 5, 6, 7.
Because he does have that, it's... They sort of have those moments throughout the play where it's clear that he's always liked her, like, you know, as literally as children, he was sort of in the way that little kids are in love with her. And then when the Soviets come in and they're all at the dance together and he says, well, you know, now Jews and Poles are equal, so we can have a drink together and we can dance together. I like the character. For as a character, he absolutely sucks, but the concept of the character I really like, because you have this shimmering in and out of, you know, like you say, one of the classmates comes back to take Rahelka, now Mariana, away, and she's pregnant. Mm-hmm. And Vladek realizes that he's forgotten the whetstone for his axe, so goes back to the house and finds out that she's been taken away, and gets a gun and goes after them. And spoiler alert, shoots the classmate to save her.
Yeah.
And
either says or thinks in his head, classmate to classmate.
Yeah. Oh yeah, because he shoots him in the stomach, doesn't he? And then the classmate is like, please kill me. This is so painful. Just Jesus, put me out of my misery. And then he says, oh, so it, you know, I shot him in the ear, classmate to classmate.
Mm-hmm.
And you just kind of go, ugh. So when he does things like that, you go, oh my God, he must really love her and care for her.
Yeah.
But then later, you know, as we said, she's, you know, she's pregnant. They go on the run because, you know, the classmate was a policeman, you know, so that the Nazis are going to come calling. They're going to want to hunt down whoever's done it. And then, you know, Rahelka / Mariana goes into labor in a ditch and the baby dies. And Vladek's version is, oh, she was, you know, she had a few hours of life, but, you know, she didn't survive, and maybe it was best because we couldn't have survived with a baby on the run. And Rahelka says, I think he smothered her while I slept.
Yeah.
And you just go, and so just that constant shimmering back and forth between not really liking the characters or being like, yay, you know, he did the right thing, but then intensely disliking him at the same time because he just also does the wrong thing as well, or potentially does the wrong thing.
Yeah, like one heroic act doesn't like redeem you of everything. Yeah.
See ya.
Yeah, and then on the other side of that, we have Zilcha, who was hiding Dora's husband and
Menachem. Yeah.
Yeah. And then ultimately, gets away to America, stays with Abram for a bit, and experiences anti-Semitism there. She's Catholic, but people judging her and calling her, like, you know, a Jew-loving whore. And
because her husband, because doesn't she get, I think it's Abram, either Abram or Menachem nominate her as a righteous among the Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
And then in that way, her American husband finds out, or who she thinks is her American husband, finds out that she was saving Jews and holds it against her. And then after he dies, she finds out that his father died in Treblinka. So she's like, what?
What is going on?
Yeah.
It's a very sad, hard play.
It really is. And it's so...
Because you're seeing this rejection of Jewish identity, because it's just been like put from the Jewish characters growing up in this village. It's been ingrained in them that that's a mark, and others them.
Yeah.
Which is horrible.
Major spoiler alert, but when Abram, you know, realizes from America that nothing is being done about what happened with the massacre, so then he writes to the Polish authorities and says, what are you doing, or the Soviet authorities, what are you doing about this? And lists all of his family members who were died, who were murdered, and there's, you know, dozens literally. And it's I think it's a really interesting device because it has the potential to be boring, because the audience are going to be sitting there, and he sort of says, also my mother Estica, and my brother and my cousin and my uncle, and gives all their names, and it's kind of that sort of shifting of, you know, okay, we get it, okay. But then at the very end, spoiler alert, skip this bit if you don't want to know what happens at the end. Sort of at the end, we sort of have the final speech from Rahelka about her life now that she's an old lady, and what she's doing and how she receives letters from Abram. And then the final monologue that we hear is from Abram listing off all of his descendants and who he has, and his grandchildren and his great-grandchildren and all of these descendants. And then, you know, saying, I still think of you, and, you know, I can't come back to Poland now because I can't walk, but please come and see me.
Yeah. There was a really lovely thing that the actor did, the production did, and the actor did for that, where, because it kind of, just the way he was listing again, you know, there, you'd feel the audience being like, okay, here we go again. And like, it just got to a point, it was like, I think he went off script. He was just going, he was listing different names. Like, he paused and, like, said another name, looking at people in the audience, like they were, you know, his descendants. Then he turns to his castmates, who are all in their, there's a running theme that they were, you know, all played football at one point and were wearing, like, shirts with numbers on them. And so, and they're off the side of the stage, like, watching him deliver this last monologue. And he says the names of all the actors. He's like, oh. Alexandra, gosh. And, like... And then, you know, and they respond like, hi. And it was just like, it was sweet. And it was also another example, the way this production is just like, we're all together in this.
But then it ties it back right round from the beginning where they all stood up and said, oh, I am. Yeah. So it's like, oh, I like that. Oh, yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
Because then it also places that question that, bearing in mind, like, Zosia's story of, you know, coming over and, you know, what we were just talking about, that whole question, especially for an American audience as well.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think you are in terms of that background, and where are your ancestors from? Where do you think, who do you think you are? Mm-hmm. Genuinely, are you sure that you know?
Not being mean about it.
Yeah, not being there. Who do you think you are? God, you are. Who do you think you are, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I like it. So, yeah, it's... I think you and I, this one's kind of wrung us out a bit, I think, because the historical context is so horrendous, like, yeah.
And the productions, I think, really sounds like it hit us hard.
Yeah, yeah. And we're,
I mean,
so
I, there was an opportunity to see it again. It moved to a different, another theater in Manhattan. First one was in Brooklyn, then they moved to Manhattan, and I was like, I want to go, but it's just...
It's a lot.
It's a matter of, like, gearing myself up. Can I spare the hydration today?
Yes, you know,
it's just, it's been very dry summer, so...
Like, well, yeah. I think... Because one of the things that we always come back to is, oh, who would this, you know, what students would this be good for, and what would be the challenges and what would be the highlights, and I think it depends, because in some ways I think this would be good for college or university level,
mm-hmm.
To as a you know, an additional way, a sort of a complementary way to explore Yed Vabner and issues of memory and contested memory and history. But then you could also flip it and say that, you know, you could follow a path of looking at each of the characters and seeing what happens to them. You know, so when one of the Catholic classmates becomes a priest, and then you can look at issues around, you know, complicity on one hand of the Catholic Church. But then on the other, things like when we had Stephen on and we were discussing about Bishop von Galen, who was one of, you know, Hitler's most staunch opponents in the Catholic Church. What happens to Dora, and situating the situation of Jewish women Vladek and that notion of, was he a righteous Gentile? Was because he saved Rahalka? Was he not because of things that he did and didn't do? And anti-Semitism in general and how it rears its head and how it's ingrained.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I recommend the play.
Me too.
Definitely. It is,
Yeah.
it's a grappler and you,
Yeah.
it's gnarly and it's hard and it's sickening and provocative and horrifying. And it sounds like this is all hyperbole. Please read the play. We promise you it's not.
And yeah, and now I'm like realizing very, very, very few stage directions that I think, especially in a drama class, that gives a lot of freedom. It's just like, okay, how exactly would you want to convey this?
Yeah, and that idea of feeding it back into imagination and filling in the blanks for yourself, and just the whole thing, just with the stage directions and the characters and the narrative and the way it's done, just is so, so clever, I think.
It's almost poetic,
and
honestly. Well,
yeah, because it feeds
the
into
way
that narrative of, what do you know? What do you think you know? Let's give you the bare facts that this thing happened. Off you go. It got us good.
Yeah. All right. Well,
so
until next time.
Yeah. Look after yourselves, look after each other. Drink water, I think, is your,
yeah, it's,
that's important. Stay hydrated.
It's, I have to constantly remind myself.
So yeah, till next time, take care, be kind, look after each other, and we will see you soon.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.